This is The Den Show.
I'm Chris Kay and welcome to The Den Show. This is your audio martial arts magazine with news, events, features, interviews and tons more. The podcast covers everything from kung fu to kickboxing to BJJ and taekwondo. Coming up, a profile of self-help guru, writer, author, filmmaker, martial artist and teacher, Jeff Thompson.
I started the martial art when I was about 11, like most kids, because I was bullied.
Kevin O'Hagan on training for MMA fights.
Train twice a day, probably 6 days a week, and it can be really demanding even for somebody in their 20s. If you're going to do it properly, then it is a massive sacrifice.
And Ian Abernethy with some recommended reading.
Well, if you want realism, you know, I would recommend Peter Considine's Streetwise.
This is The Den Show with Chris Kay. News.
So let's check out some of the news stories making the headlines at thedenshow.com. Sarah Stevenson has clinched a gold medal at the Taekwondo World Championships in Korea. The Doncaster fighter overcame the favourite Hwang Kyung-seon, the Olympic and world champion, in her semi-final before beating China's Yunfei Gyu. Expect an explosive night of fight action on Saturday the 21st of May as Bama 6 hits Wembley Arena in London. British action star Scott Adkins is joining the cast of John Hyam's Universal Soldier New Dimension. The film reunites Adkins with Jean-Claude Van Damme, who he co-stars with in the upcoming Weapon, and Dolph Lundgren also reprises his role in the franchise. Speaking of Jean-Claude Van Damme, the action superstar is full of regret for his adulterous past, insisting he hasn't forgiven himself for leaving his wife Gladys. The martial arts actor met former bodybuilder Gladys Portuguese when they were both in their early 20s, and they fell madly in love before tying the knot in 1987. But he still hasn't forgiven himself for betraying her. The British Judo Association is reporting that European medalist Colin Oates will compete in the 2011 Baku Grand Prix along with Ashley McKenzie and Gemma Howell. On a high from winning a bronze at the European Championships, a career best for the 27-year-old, Oates will take to the mat in the 66-kilogram weight category. Oates reached fifth place in the 2010 Moscow Grand Prix and will be looking to consolidate his European medal. And Reuters is reporting that Hong Kong Airlines has made it mandatory for cabin crew to train in Wing Chun in order to deal with drunk and unruly passengers. At least three in-flight incidents are recorded every week, and the airline says the training will boost general fitness as well as help control difficult passengers. Finally, for now, music star Katie B has taken up kickboxing to help deal with the stresses of life in the music industry. The On A Mission singer recently earned her yellow belt. Speaking to Pop Dash, Katie revealed how she relaxes away from work. She says, "I like kickboxing. I started recently and I got my yellow belt the other day. I also really like getting massages, so I try and get one whenever I'm out on tour." And you can check out more news online at thedenshow.com.
History.
Now let's welcome onto the Den Show Paul Gray, who is a Bristol-based instructor with the British Krav Maga Association. Hi, Paul.
Hi, everybody.
So this is an Israeli martial art, and can you tell me a little bit about the origins of the system and how it developed?
The story behind Krav Maga is quite an epic, really. It was founded by a gentleman by the name of Imi Sidor, and Imi was a gymnast, boxer, and a sort of national standard wrestler. Imi was involved in training through his father called Samuel, who trained the local police in Bratislava. And Imi developed an interest in, I would guess, what you'd call sort of early European martial arts, namely boxing and wrestling. Over time, the life became very difficult for Jewish people in Europe, obviously because of what was going on in Germany and things. And the level of aggression they faced was probably unprecedented, sort of in modern history. And as stateless persons, they had no rights. So you could steal from them, rape them, murder them, and there would be no consequence. So what would happen is these people would be exposed to this level of risk, and they were looking for a way to learn to protect themselves. And this is where the training that Imi had learned in boxing and wrestling, he started to apply it on the street. Now, as you probably expect, he had teething problems trying to apply this type of fighting system to sort of a scenario where perhaps there's multiple attackers or edge weapons or even firearms. And this was kind of where Krav Maga started to become founded. And the experience that Imi had during this time really started him thinking and started the ball rolling for what was to become known as Krav Maga later on in the 1940, after 1948 in Israel. So this is really how the system started. In terms of what we understand Krav Maga to be today, people tend to focus on what happened in Israel and basically the role of Krav Maga within the Israeli Defense Force as their hand-to-hand combat system. So this is where Krav Maga has come from as far as most people are concerned. And basically it became very famous because of the work by a gentleman called Darren Levine, who did a very good job in publicizing Krav Maga across the world. And his work has basically made Krav Maga an international phenomena. So really, it's because of the work of Imi and Darren publicizing this that's made Krav Maga so well known, really. So there's a very, very short history of it. But the story of it is worth looking into if you're interested in Krav Maga.
Brilliant. Paul, thank you very much for being on The Den Show today and chatting with me.
My pleasure, mate. Thank you very much for your time.
This is The Den Show.
You can now follow The Den Show on Twitter and join The Den Show group on Facebook as well. Just do a little search on both of those social networking sites for The Den Show. And there's various ways to listen as well. You can stream The Den Show at thedenshow.com or download and subscribe via iTunes or podomatic.com.
This is The Den Show with Chris Kay.
Still to come, I'll be chatting to Jeff Thompson.
So I went into Shoutcam. That was really, really, really tough.
Feature.
So let's welcome on to The Den Show Kevin O'Hagan. He is a 6th Dan in combat jiu-jitsu. He's a senior instructor with the British Combat Association. He's fought competitively and he's a writer and author, and he's got TV credits to his name as well. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Chris.
How do you get someone ready for a fight in the cage?
Right. Most of my guys, if they come to train with me, if they're starting from scratch, then we train them to, first of all, start off in the amateur arena. So the amateur MMA doesn't have any head contact. So you can strike, kick, you know, knee to body, legs, there's takedown submission, but there's no actual head contact standing on the floor. That's a good way to expose yourself to what MMA is all about and improve your grappling skills, because in the amateurs, most of it will come down to whether you can submit somebody. Very rare would you finish anybody with strikes. Once they've experienced that, then we would move them on to the semi-pro arena, where there's stand-up strikes to the head, but not on the floor. And then eventually we would have them ready by then for full pro rules, which includes all strikes to the head, standing and on the floor as well. So there's a gradual progression. I wouldn't sort of throw somebody straight into the pro end of things. I think in this day and age, sometimes the pro tag in MMA is taken too lightly, and there's a lot of guys in there fighting pro that are really not ready for it. So I tend to try and bring them right through amateur, semi-pro before they're ready to step into the cage at that level, which requires a great deal of training, knowledge, and obviously fitness.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're going to be like a proper like MMA fighter, it's like a full-time job almost, isn't it?
Well, it is. Yeah, really. You'd have to have the luxury of being able to, say, train twice a day, probably 6 days a week. I've had a few people that's been able to do that. Most of my other guys, though, are still trying to hold down jobs, family lives, and fit that training in between, which is very difficult. I can appreciate that myself. When I was competing at my highest level, I was still running all my classes, still doing some part-time work, still looking after family and having to train twice a day on top of that. And it can be really demanding, even for somebody in their 20s, let alone their 40s. So if you're going to do it properly, then it is a massive sacrifice, and you've really got to be 100% behind it.
And if you are going to do that, I mean, what skills do you normally practice, and what conditioning do you give to these potential athletes to get them ready?
Well, the skills-wise, you're going to have a good cross-section. What I always say about MMA is you haven't got to be a master of one particular range, but you've got to have a good working knowledge of it. So you'd have to have a good fundamental knowledge of boxing, Thai boxing, wrestling, and then obviously jiu-jitsu, grappling on the floor. So with my classes, we're probably one of the only classes within Bristol that teaches actual MMA. What I try to do is to fuse all those things together. So rather than having totally separate classes for boxing, wrestling, which some of it's relevant, but some of it isn't for the cage, what you've got to do is try and take the best bits of those arts and make it relevant and workable in the cage. You could be the best wrestler under the sun, but if you haven't got any knowledge of any stand-up stuff whatsoever, you're going to have problems. Same token, you could be a great boxer, but if you're taken down in the first couple of minutes of a fight, then boxing's gone out the window. So you've got to learn the fundamentals of wrestling if you want to stay in the cage and let your upright stuff work as well. So it's very much trying to continually circle round all these things and fit it into MMA rather than teaching them as separate arts.
Excellent. Kevin, thank you very much for being on the Den Show today.
It was a pleasure, Chris, to talk to you. Anytime, mate. You're welcome.
This is the Den Show with Chris Kay.
Right, let's welcome onto the Den Show Ian Abernethy. Ian holds a sixth Dan with the British Combat Association. He regularly writes for the UK's leading martial arts magazines and is well known for his pragmatic approach to karate and his work with kata application. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
I just thought I would perhaps get some recommendations from you for reading. So are there any books that you would say these you should definitely look at?
Well, aside from mine.
Of course.
Well, mine, obviously. Right? When they've read mine, there's some other ones I can recommend. One thing, it depends on what people want from a book, really. I think what sometimes people want is they want me to say, get this book and this will have all your answers within it. And it doesn't work that way. It's that acquisition of knowledge through... I might buy a book, I might read it all, and there might be one paragraph that really makes sense to me. But one that I would... everyone should start with. If you want realism, you know, I would recommend Jeff Thompson's Dead or Alive. I think he's probably one of the best books out there on self-defense. I would add to that Rory Miller's Meditations on Violence and Peter Considine's Streetwise. They would probably be my top three for the realism side of things. I think if you read those three, you've got a pretty good handle on the basics, I think.
It's quite expensive now, Streetwise.
I believe so. Yeah, it's well worth it though. It's a superb book. So if you can get hold of a copy of it, it's very good.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for being on the Den Show today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Profile. So let's welcome on to the Den Show Jeff Thompson, the author of Watch My Back and the man behind the film Clubbed as well. Jeff is a bit of a Coventry legend, successful writer, filmmaker, motivator, and self-help guru as well. Thank you for being on the show today.
Pleasure.
First of all, just take me through how you got involved in the martial arts.
I started the martial arts when I was about 11, like most kids, because I was bullied. I probably wasn't. The bullying, I was quite a sensitive kid, so the bullying probably wasn't as overt as what it probably wasn't as overt as it seemed. But I felt bullied. There was a couple of bullies I had at school, and I wanted to do something about that, really. I wanted to overcome my fears. That's kind of been the whole aspect of my life, really, is about overcoming fear, because I felt that everything I wanted to achieve and all the happiness I wanted was just beyond that line of fear that kept popping up. So I started in Aikido when I was probably 11 or 12, and did that for a couple of years. So I built up a bit of confidence, then got it shattered. And I kind of had a couple of years away from that, then went back into the martial arts again for the same reason, for the same searches, the feeling of doing something, you know, living day to day and feeling fearful. I don't mean all the time. I had long periods of bliss and happiness and, you know, like most kids, but this feeling of depression and fear just blighted me. It wasn't like just ordinary fear to me. It came into my life and debilitated me. You know, it took the joy out of everything I did. So this martial arts was my way of trying to develop some kind of sovereignty over these fears. So I went into Shotokan That was really, really, really tough. Really tough. I did that for a couple of years, and then I came away from Shotokan, went into Kung Fu, Mokgar Kung Fu. Went into that for a while, again up to instructor level, then moved back to Shotokan because I was about a purple belt in Shotokan, then got my black belt in Shotokan. Then I started to explore judo and some of the other systems that were in the Bunkai of karate.
You used to train with the KUGB guys.
Yeah, I got my second dan with them. I got my second dan with Anoida. I started way back in the early days with Rick and Mick Jackson. All my gradings, all my early gradings, I've still got the license book actually, but they were all with Kawazoe back in the 70s.
Hmm.
And then the dan grade with Anoida and the second dan with Anoida. Then I started to, like I said, I went on the doors and I wanted to explore. So I felt like, for me, I felt like basic Shotokan was like the trunk of a big tree. And if you look at a tree, it tends to be a lot of trunk for a while, and then it starts to branch out. So I started to do that. I started to look at the Bunkai in karate and started to branch out and follow it. And the Bunkai took me into judo, took me into wrestling, took me into jiu-jitsu, you know, took me into Western boxing. It took me into lots of different systems. I went into Thai, I went into some collegiate wrestling, I went right back to the old catch wrestling, catches, catch can, hook wrestling. I explored it massively. I really explored it a lot when I gave up my job. Once the book came out and I started doing a bit more teaching, I gave up my job and started to train full time, teach full time and write. So it gave me a lot of time to do lots and lots of systems. So I started to work with some of the best people in the world, really. And that's where my game really expanded.
So did you find, you know, exploring the karate Bunkai, that there was elements missing from what you were being taught? Like, most clubs, you know, they won't teach the locks and the throws and everything else that's in there. You've got to kind of know what you're looking for.
Well, when I was a purple belt, I think I was about 15, and I stood in a pub and I saw a fight kick off, and I remember thinking, how the f*** am I going to fit karate into that? It was so volatile, so messy and scruffy and so violent and explosive. I just didn't know what I'd got would fit into that. It made no sense to me at all. But I didn't, you know, I felt the failure was in me. I kept looking and thinking, like, this system's, you know, 100 years old. It must be just me. And my instructors have told me it works, so it must be just me. But every time I saw a fight, it made me question it more and more. I just kept thinking, I couldn't see how all this stuff, the way it was being taught, would fit in. And I would ask questions at the karate. And, you know, they were doing Bunkai, where lots of the Bunkai, the adaptations were chokes and strangles and, locks and bars and you know, ashiwazas, you know, like the sweeps. And the lots of the tachiwaza from judo was in there, you know, the taitoshis, the ouchis, the kouchis, the osotos. They're all in the kata. Lots, even like the shimiwaza, you know, the strangles, I found all that in there. So I was kind of saying, well, all this is judo. So I think I'm going to look at judo. And my instructor said, oh, you can't go to judo. Why not? Well, if you get a license for judo, they'll kick you out of the association. You're either with us or you're not. And that just felt really juvenile to me. That made no sense. It sounded like a jealous husband. So I was kind of saying, well, if this stuff's in here, why don't we practice that? Because it's no good just taking the Bunkai out and looking at it and, and then kind of separating the technique and then drilling the technique. You needed to really put that Bunkai into sparring and into randori to see, you know, to develop proper use of it. So I kind of was questioning it. I could see all this stuff there. The katas were rich with it, but nobody was really. They were talking about it and teaching it, but only kind of, fundamentally. They weren't actually like, if they were showing you, like a throw that was in the Bunkai, they weren't showing you how to actually do that against someone who was trying to stop you. For me, I just what I did with my own class, I just let it naturally adapt. So we used to just do progressive sparring, which was the early Animal Day stuff, where any range went, anything you wanted to do. So if you threw a kick and you got your foot caught, then you'd end up on the floor. If someone left themselves open, you could bite them. You could put your finger in their eye. You know, all of it with control. But, you know, everything was open. If someone, you know, their b****s were open, then you could grab their b****s. You know, I just wanted to, I wanted to make it as honest as I could, you know, and I also wanted to, I didn't want to just know how to do a taritoshi. I wanted to know how to do a taritoshi against somebody that was trying to stop me, because the technique for taritoshi, you know, on a compliant partner is completely different to the technique on a person that's not compliant.
You only have to look at any judo match anyway, and how difficult is it to get a perfect throw and get the point for it, you know, and in a proper violent situation, it's going to be even worse, isn't it?
It's so, so unpredictable. So I wanted to recreate that, really. Then again, this all clashes with when I went on the door. I went on the door to pressure test myself, to, you know, to overcome my own fears, to see what worked and what didn't work. And when I was on the door, I realised that we were doing it all wrong. You know, it was so foreign. It was like I'd gone on the door with 9,009. I'd gone on the door with, you know, like 10,000 techniques, and 9,999 of them weren't working. So I come back to my class and I said, "We're doing this all wrong," and I changed everything. I started to put pressure into everything we did. I started to apply pressure to everything, and I started to isolate the stuff that I knew worked. Preemption worked every single time. You know, artifice and preemption worked every single time, even for people that weren't that good. So I started to isolate that and work on it. I started to look at the stuff that wasn't working, that was decoration, stuff that, you know, was seemed very superfluous to the combat. And I just dropped it, to be honest, just let go of it. It was, you know, it was just, it was like someone has painted legs on snakes. So I just got rid of it. I just concentrated purely on what worked. Obviously, that became a bit boring because there's not a lot of stuff that does, you know, does work. So later on, I was able to let go of that as well. And later on, I went back to the art and just practiced art. So when I went heavily into wrestling, heavily into judo, I was a full-time judo player for nearly 2 years. When I went very heavily into that, I wasn't really bothered about whether it worked in the street because I'd already been in hundreds of fights. So I knew what worked. I knew how to do that. You know, I knew how to turn up at somebody's house and make that work. I'd done it a lot of times.
But you knew the difference and why you were training for that.
Absolutely. I just separated it so it became, this is martial, this is art. And I really love the art side of it. I became a good grappler. You know, I went heavily into scrimmage. I was having private lessons with the American wrestling coach. I had a private lesson in Las Vegas with the Machados. You know, I was working with Chris Whelan, who was the number one Greco-Roman fighter in America. He was stopped at my house. I was working on the ground with Rick Young. Rick Young used to come and stop at my house. I was working with Neil Adams' full-time class. It was an Olympic class. But that was purely just the art. I mean, obviously, you learn to kill people with that because you're going straight into strangulation. But I really, really let go of the need to have a fight at that point and started to concentrate just on the art. And obviously, it's still what it is, and it's still deadly because you're working with very good people. But the need to do it physically outside was no longer there for me. When you've been in lots of fights and you've hurt lots of people, and you see the result of all that, and then you have to atone for that, you don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to be in conflict with anybody. You know, if anybody wants to come and see me, I'll give them a hug and buy them a coffee. I don't want that in my life because it's below my game. You know, it's the game of ignorant people, and I was there for a long time. I know there's a much bigger game. There's a much, you know, this kind of metaphysical game of, you know, finding higher frequencies and working techniques, working invisible techniques, if you like. But, I mean, I had to go through the physical stuff. I had to exhaust that. I had to take it right to the level where, you know, where literally you can kill somebody. Literally, you put a strangle on, and whether they stay alive or not is your choice, not theirs. That's the level you take it to. And when you get to that level, and you've got somebody in your lap who's unconscious, and their eyes are bulging, and you're thinking, this is not where I want to be, you suddenly spill over into a much bigger game, and you think, okay, what's bigger than this? Where can I go from here? You know, I've learned this. I've hit this from every single angle. I've got, you know, 2,000 ways of killing somebody. You know, I've done, you know, 20 exotic different arts. You know, if I let my hands go, it's like a gun's gone off. But that's the small game. That's the small jihad. Where's the big game? That's when I started to go and internalize it and start to work on cleansing, started to work on higher frequencies of compassion, frequencies of understanding, ultimately frequencies of love, where I am really serving people. So that if I'm stood in a room, as Don Drager said, if I'm stood in a room full of people, they're better protected just because I'm there. Not because I can protect them against other people, but they're protected against me. I'm not going to fall out with them and be physical with them because they've upset my ego. You know, I'm going to do my very best to befriend them, to find a frequency of love. And it's really difficult. To be honest, it makes the dwarf seem easy by comparison. You know, but that's the kind of stuff I love. That comes from Ushabha, comes from, Funakoshi, comes from, ultimately when, with Musashi, when Musashi got to his top game, Yagua, all the top people, all the people I love, Draga, they all found this level where it was about working shamanically at higher frequencies and spreading love and healing people and doing it non-violently. Gandhi being my ultimate hero, so it's but it's all at the top end of martial, it's all where it's built into the art side of it. Because like I say, there's one of the beautiful things about hurting other people physically is that you definitely, unequivocally, without any question, you know that it's not right, it's wrong, and it just keeps rebounding on itself. And I did it a lot, and I wouldn't change that. But I'm still atoning for a lot of that. It's been a very painful process for me. But all I want to do now is, as much as I can, is serve people with love.
Jeff, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate you giving me some of your airspace.
This is The Den Show.
So that just about wraps up this edition of The Den Show. And don't forget, you can leave your feedback on the podcast. Let me know your thoughts and feelings. What did you like? What would you like to hear more of? You can contact me via thedenshow.com, or you can tweet or leave me a message via Facebook. But for now, thank you for listening.
This is The Den Show with Chris Kaye.